My next guest, I remember being just a youthful headbanger, going to the Civic Center in Hammond, Indiana, and watching Blue Oyster Cult and waiting, just waiting with bated breath for the drummer to put on the Godzilla head for the classic Godzilla song. We're going to take a moment here to introduce you to the reimagined version of Imaginos, a classic album made by Blue Oyster Cult. And we're going to open up. It's got a different bit of a track listing. And we're going to talk to Albert about all the new things that he's brought to this. Let's open with a classic song from that album that I think all BOC fans love. It's called I Am the One You Warned Me Of. Yes, indeed. Albert Bouchard joining us.
Fresh from zone of moisture, and afterward, the meat. Spangles and my long-tailed suits and songs to haunt the one that saved. Just call me Desanova. I'm sure to be the lucky one when destiny assigns wisdom known to me, the starry wisdom.
Yeah!
I Am the One You Warned Me Of. That is a new take on it, a reimagining, if you will, or a reimaginos, if you will. Albert Bouchard recreating a project that he started as a very young man along with the late, great Sandy Pearlman. And it is finally coming to fruition. Of course, we had the 1988 Blue Oyster Cult version. We had heard of the many things that were happening with this album over the years. If you were a fan of BOC, a fan of the Bouchard brothers, this is not a strange thing for you. Imaginos may not have been a commercial hit per se like some of the others, but it certainly is one of those legendary albums. Kind of like Smile for Brian Wilson, I guess. One of those things that took forever to get out, but it's here. And we have the man himself, Albert Bouchard, with us. Albert, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for the great introduction, Tom.
What a great honor it is to have you here, and what a great album you've created. We have waited for so long to hear the way you intended it to sound. The tracking, as I mentioned prior to playing that song, is different. The sequencing, rather. There's some songs that are here that we haven't heard, and there's a few that are missing, perhaps, because I know the original plan was a double album, and you have 12 tracks on here, whereas the BOC right. version, I think, was 9? If I remember right. So
I think
So what was the problem here? I mean, this is a beautiful piece, and Sandy and you worked so hard for so many decades. What took so long to finally get you here where you are to be able to interpret it, sing it, perform it, and arrange it the way you envisioned it in your head so many years ago?
Well, part of the problem was that it was Sandy Perlman's he had a very relaxed idea. He was like, this is the big chance we have. We can take as long as we want to do it. We've got an unlimited budget just about from Columbia. They've given us carte blanche. And the problem was that it took so long to do because after about a year and a half, the people that had signed me, had signed the contract for this record, had left the company. And there was a whole other group of people in there that were not, we're talking about Columbia Records.
Right, right.
So there was these people who didn't care about this project, and they kept, saying, that they're not going to promote it, and we'd say, well, why not? And it's nothing commercial. And then it was the vocals. And then so we got another singer and a fantastic singer, somebody who's inarguably great. And they still didn't like the vocals. And I'm like, well, what are we going to do? So
right.
Eventually what happened was, originally it was supposed to be a Blue Oyster Cult record before it was my solo record. But they didn't want to do that. So what happened was when they wouldn't put out my record, Sandy went to Blue Oyster Cult and said, please, guys, we'll overdub your vocals, put your stuff, we'll put some of your performances on it, and we'll call it a Blue Oyster Cult record. That's the only way that Columbia would put it out.
Hmm.
So that's what happened. And because they were trying to, they changed everything on me. They were like, no, it's not going to be a double record. It's going to be a single record. And I had recorded like over 70 minutes of music. So we had to cut it down. We cut two songs out. Gil Blanco County and A Girl That Loved Me Blind. And of course, one of the other things about the record was that it was not just a normal record. It was, at the time, I was calling it a rock opera.
Okay.
But to be honest, I had never really seen an opera at that point in my life. My only exposure to opera was Tommy.
Right. Yeah, I never understood the rock opera, you know, label. I mean, there's really not any opera, unless you're Freddie Mercury. There's really no opera influences in this. But this was like something that L. Ron Hubbard or H.P. Lovecraft would have created with a lot of guitars and drums. And the fact that they took the songs out of sequence and changed the story, it reminds me, going back similar era, and maybe you knew and maybe you didn't, the late, great Billy Thorpe, when he did Children of the Sun, he had a vision for that. Yeah. And they wound up shortening it to make it one album. Of course, later he released Part Two, which was one side of the second album, which kind of, it just lost the magic. And I felt that way reading about this project for so many years and then finally hearing it. Of course, I enjoyed the songs, but it seemed to have lost the magic that we were anticipating. It was a gothic piece of history, literature, sci-fi, all wrapped up into one thing. And I'm just so happy to be able to hear it now.
Well, thank you. I had thought about doing this, when Sandy was sick in the hospital and before he passed, I had gone and visited him for a couple of days and he couldn't speak at that point. He had, he'd been in a coma and he came out of the coma and, his brain was not functioning, like it's supposed to. And, so at the time he couldn't really move anything, but his left foot. He could move his left foot and he could grab your hand. So he would grab my hand when I was talking to him, but he couldn't respond to me. So I was just going and talking about this and that and the other thing and saying how, this was, that I really wanted to go back and revisit this thing and do it the way it should be done. And this is why he needed to get the better.
Right.
Give
him something to live for.
Yeah. That you got to get better because we have to correct this travesty of our art. When he died, of course, it was in my mind, but then it was like, oh well, I guess I don't have to do it right away.
Right.
It took me a little while. I think that for many years, Sandy and I. We're not on good terms, basically because of what happened with the record, I was like, you sold me out, and he's like, I did what I had to do, Now with perspective, I can see that, he was, he had as much skin in the game as me and he was backed into a corner and there was nothing he could do.
You left BOC in 1981, and there was a big dust-up. I mean, you're talking about with you and Sandy, but there was also with the members of the band. There were lawsuits tossed about. Sandy tried to continue things on. But in recent years, the last several years, rather, it seems like everyone is kind of grown up a little bit or matured or somehow come to terms. You're actually on the new BOC album, Symbol Remains, and Eric and Donald have worked with you. And of course, you and Joe, being brothers, have worked on the Blue Coop stuff. You've guessed it on each other's albums. It seems like everything is copacetic. Is it safe to say? Because, as a fan of the band and your fans in general, everyone was like, we like what everyone's doing, but if we could get the guys back together, it'd be awesome. So I don't know if it's gotten that good where you guys will actually do a original lineup album at any point.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
I think that they're very happy with the musicians that they have now. The current membership of the band is, I think, very strong. I went out on the road with almost the same lineup in 2016, except for they had Kasim Sultan playing the bass.
Oh, okay.
And not Danny Miranda. But Danny is a great player, and Danny and I have collaborated on other stuff outside of Blue Oyster Cult. So, I wouldn't want to take anybody's job away, to be frank. So I wouldn't be into that. From my audience perspective, from a fan perspective, there's a certain catharsis that they they get when they see the guys, you know, the original guys. But, you know, you can't really have the original band anymore anyway because Alan's gone.
Right, Alan is no longer, yeah.
Alan Lanier passed away. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm happy to play with them. You know, anytime they want me to come out and do some songs and whatnot, you know, I'm fine with that. You know, really is no hard feelings.
That's good to know. That's very good to know. And I got that feeling with Joe when I had Joe on a couple months ago. He was here to talk about Strange Legends, and he kind of had the same groove. He's like, yeah, you know, we all grew up. We're all friends again. We're all, you know, everything comes, if you live long enough, everything comes back full circle.
Right.
So,
right. I mean, you know, I was never distant from Eric Bloom because Eric was, you know, Eric was very much not in favor of me leaving the band,
mm-hmm.
but he, as he said, listen, you know, I got to go with what the other guys want, you know?
Right. Right.
I mean, I'm not going to say I'm going with you, Albert.
Right. Right. I'm going to walk away from a band that's cranking out hits at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He said, I couldn't do that.
So first,
they voted and I had to go with them.
First time I met you was, I want to say it was 78 or 79. And, you guys were playing at the Hammond Civic Center in Hammond, Indiana. It was one of the first shows where you were using all the lasers. And Eric was bouncing them off the guitar and his wrists and everything. And the thing I remember most when someone says Albert Bouchard, and I mentioned it in the beginning of the show today, and I don't think you were listening, is that I would wait for the moment when the Godzilla head would come out and you would put the Godzilla head to play the drums. And I never understood how you could do that because that thing looks so big and so heavy. And hot. I mean, tell me a little bit about what it was like to be in the Godzilla head at the moment.
I'll tell you this, that it was really great to take it off.
It reminds me.
Like,
you know,
oh my God, I can breathe again.
I see the Masked Singer on TV and it reminds me of you. It's like, hey, he did that way long ago.
Yeah. But try and play the, I mean, drums are very physical. You know, mm-hmm. You know, even now when I play the drums, they come off and I'm soaked. I'm just soaked. So, but, you know, I had so many drums, you just throw your arms out and you're going to hit something.
Right. That was so
I
classic.
I really couldn't see, but I kind of knew kind of sort of where things were. And, you know, I mean, and it's kind of, you know, you always wonder, well, you know, what if I lost my sight? You know, would I be able to function? You know, would I be like, you know, would I be a musical genius or just me with no sight? I think I'd just be me.
the high school teenage memories of Blue Oyster Cult and UFO, those are the two bands that I followed, you know, wholeheartedly. You were a highlight of that moment. So thank you from the teenage part of me many decades ago for creating those memories. Speaking of memories, this album is dedicated, the Reimaginos, which I love the title. I mean, it's just, it's a given, Reimaginos. It's dedicated to Sandy. As you mentioned, you guys bonded again toward the end. I think he'd be thrilled with this.
I know he would.
The thing that kind of always threw me is I always thought Alan Lanier was the sci-fi guy of the band, and yet you and Perlman created this. So Alan didn't have a big part in this, did he?
No, Alan was not the sci-fi guy in the band. It was Eric and me.
Okay, Eric I knew was a comic book guy. I knew that.
Yeah, me too.
Okay.
So, you know, but he turned me on to Michael Moorcock, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading a Michael Moorcock book, and he goes, oh, my God, this guy is so great. You know, you gotta get all the books, you know. So he actually got me, you know, the Elric series. He got me all of those books. And mm-hmm. then, of course, we did, we ended up doing Black Blade which is direct, you know, directly about the Elric. You know, because Michael Moorcock not only sci-fi, but he also did sword and sorcery kind of books. You know, taking place in the back in the Stone Age.
The Blue Oyster Cult legend, the legacy, I should say, is strong and still alive and well. What was it like to be able to go back and be part of the new album? Again, the new one came out, and for the listeners, it's called The Symbol Remains. You play cowbell, of course, vocals, percussion on, I think it was the opening song, That Was Me. Were you, what was it like? How did the invitation come about to be on that? I think that was a Band-Aid for the fans to see you on there, because a lot of people were commenting online. It's like, Albert's sitting in with the guys. You know, it was a come to Jesus moment for a lot of us.
It was fun and it was funny. I got a call from the manager, Steve Shank, and said, "Hey, would you be into doing this?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, time is tight. You know, we're mixing soon. You know," and I'm like, "Okay, have Richie give me the call." So Richie Castellano, who was the co-producer, he called me and. I'd already worked with Richie. Every Sunday he does a podcast. Ever since the quarantine, since March, he's been doing these live shows on YouTube. And so what he does is he has backing tracks, and he will ask people to contribute to the backing track. So I've done a few of those. I played guitar on one. I played drums on another. I sang on another. So Richie knows I got a whole setup in my house. And actually, he's come over to my house and we've written songs and done a whole bunch of stuff together. So he knew that I could do it. So he said, "I'll send you the track. Here's what I want. I want you to sing the harmony part." He said, "I've sung it, so you just sing what I'm singing." I said, "Okay." Okay, and he said, "And then if you can think of any percussion, you know, maybe a cowbell or something," I said, "Sure, I'll do that." You know, I said, "Do you want want a Latin thing, right? You know, some claves?" Like, no, like, you know, just like Reaper, to four on, you know, quarter notes. I'm like, "I get it. Okay, I can do that." So he sent me the track, the same, all in one day. So he sends me the track. I sing it. I actually sang a whole bunch of other different parts, you know, like little harmony parts here and there. I don't know if they used them or not. I can't really tell. But and then I did a whole bunch of percussion stuff and keyboards and, you know, he said, "Just do whatever you want, you know, and we don't have to use it. You know, you might not use it." But so I did all this stuff and he calls me back the next day. He says, "Hey, man, that was great. You know, we can't use the keyboard part because it's just too much in that section. And then a lot of these percussions, there's too much going on," he said. "But the cowbell," he said, "you got anything bigger?" I said, "Sure." I played I endorse Latin percussion, and they make a cowbell. It's called the Moore cowbell, right?
Okay.
So I said, "Well, I use the LP Moore cowbell. It sounds exactly like the Reaper." He goes, "I know. I don't want that sound. I want a big cowbell." So I said, "Okay, I've got a 10-inch cowbell. It's huge." He said, "That's the one." You know, so I put it down, and that's actually the cowbell that he played on the record and the cowbell I did in the video. And then he said, I said, "Well, how about the background vocals?" He goes, "Well, there's a problem. You sang the wrong words." I said, "Well, you didn't give me the lyric sheet. I'm sorry." He said, "No, it's." I said, "What did I sing wrong?" And he goes, "Well, where it goes in the chorus, it goes, 'I'm the saddened man that the ladies tease.'" And I'm like, "Yeah, Saturn, like the planet, right?" And he's like, "No." Saddened, like the past tense of sad, or you know, some sort of part of, you know.
Right.
Some sort of word that probably doesn't exist. Saddened. So I'm like, "Saddened? That's terrible. Tell Eric to change it to Saturn. That's way cooler.
That's more BOC." If you say Saturn.
Yeah, exactly. And he goes, "We're mixing tomorrow." I go, "Well, mix some other song." He goes, "They're all mixed. This is the last song."
Wow.
"Eric is not going to change it. He's in Florida." I'm like, "Oh, shoot. Okay. Well, okay, I'll sing Saddened." You know, and so I did send it in, and you know, a couple days later, I said, hey, did that thing make the album? He goes, yes, going to be the first single. I'm like, what? Okay, that's cool. So, yeah, that was that was fun. But here's the crazy thing is that there's a Japanese version. Because for the Japanese album, they put a bonus cut, and it is that song with basically Richie playing an acoustic guitar, no drums, just me, all of my percussion parts, every single thing that I did is on there. You know, all the vocals, all the keyboards, and all of that.
Right.
So that's cool too.
We're gonna play a little bit of that right now. That was okay. Me. Off the Symbol Remains, but then we're going to come back and we're going to talk some more about Reimaginos and a little bit about Blue Coop. So let's play this. Listen for the percussion. Listen for the more cowbell. That was me, and this is Midwest Beat. That was him, Albert Bouchard, sitting in with his old buddies in Blue Oyster Cult off their latest album, The Symbol Remains. Albert is here to talk about his new album, though, which is Reimaginos, a reimagining of the classic Blue Oyster Cult album, Imaginos. And Albert, I gotta ask you, when you were revisiting this, there are a lot of changes, a lot of things that we didn't hear first time around, original things I'm thinking, maybe some new thoughts all these years later. What was it like to sit down with these old tracks again and look at them fresh with new eyes and new ears?
It was interesting because at first I was just, you know, I'd been playing them, you know, with my I have a little band, you know, we do some local gigs around the city, mm-hmm. New York City here, but so we were trying to work up some of these songs, and I'm like, yeah, these are great songs, you know, these are better than some of the new stuff I'm doing. So I was like, let's do these, and then as I did them, I was like, oh, wait, I think I need to change things up a little bit. You know, I right in the early part of starting to get serious about the recording, I went for a run, during the run, I was thinking a lot about Sandy and what he would say to me as we were recording them. And one of the things he said, it wasn't just Sandy was also Tom Morangelo, the musical director, was saying, you know, I don't think we need all these musicians and all these instruments. These songs should be able to, you should just be able to play them on acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And Sandy was like, yeah, I think, you know, it could be more like folk music, you know. So I thought about that and I said, you know, this is true. We'd worked up the songs at first with me playing electric guitar. And then as I was doing it, I switched to acoustic guitar, and I'm like, wait, it sounds better with the acoustic guitar. Maybe this is how we should go, you know. So that took me on a whole journey to see how could I do every one of these songs like that, like that I could just walk into a club and with my guitar and start singing, and people would, you know, I could carry a show that way, you know,
right.
Or maybe it's just a duo or, you know, or the trio that we have, you know. So it seemed to work better with the acoustic guitar. And as I did it, I found other ways to present the material, you know, like, for instance, Siege and Investiture is a very, you know, it's got a lot of bombast and, you know, it's this huge sounding thing. And mm-hmm. and I was like, well, one of the things that, you know, maybe people don't know that much is that originally when Sandy wrote the song, it was just called Siege and Investiture. And it started out with The Girl That Love Made Blind,
okay.
You know, which is the song that they left off. But
right.
Those two songs go together. They're like, they go hand in hand. They're basically the same situation, the same scenario, you know. So I thought, well, if I make Siege and Investiture more like a tango, like some sort of Latin-ish, you know, how tango is like romantic and sexy and violent.
Right, at the same time. Right.
Yep. So that was where I was going with that one. And, of course, Girl That Love Made Blind is also sort of like that, except it's more like a waltz.
That song sticks out for me. I had never heard that, Girl That Love Made Blind, and I was very impressed with that song. I enjoyed that a lot. Would you mind if I play that, at least a little of it?
Not at all. It's great, you know. I couldn't believe they left it off.
I know.
You know, there was other songs that weren't as good on the original, and I'm like, oh, you know, but whatever.
All right. This is track 5, and then when we come back, we're going to talk with Album about sequencing and how he decided, is this the original sequencing? We'll find out. This is a song you might not have heard before, Girl That Love Made Blind, and it's off Reimaginos on Demco Records.
I thought your eyes blue, oh no, they're green, she said to me. We danced in time, or didn't you know? This dance was time.
from this castle of mine. For the powers that be, the girl and her dreams.
At the party of astrologers, the Christmas tide was due. It just seems like a perfect song to play as we approach Christmas. One of those songs that I'd never heard before. So beautiful. And like you said, it's got that waltz groove to it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny because I listened to the very original, the first time that I did it, when they were just one song. And it was, you know, I found these tapes last weekend, and I just played these songs for my son, who was here, you know, who also played on the record.
Is that Ace? Keyboard.
Yeah, Ace.
Okay.
So he hears the first one. He's like, Dad, don't let anybody hear that. It's awful. I said, I know. I printed the lyrics on Facebook, I think, and people were like, oh, we've got to hear the demo. We've got to. No, you don't. Yeah, don't. Believe me. You know, that was before Sandy got involved, mm-hmm. because he'd just given me the lyric, and I wrote a tune to it. And after he heard my demo, this awful version, he was like, Albert, I think I need to come over to your house, so we need to work on this together. And he did. And so I listened to the next version of it, and it's almost identical to what you're listening to.
Okay.
But it's a bit more corny, you know. And so this version is, I tried to take the corniness out of it. I tried to make it more like a modern kind of an idea about it, you know, that this self-sacrifice and all these things that people do when they're in love, you know, so, mm-hmm. You know, more like a 50 Shades of Grey type of deal.
Right, right. We won't go there on that one. You can make a great video for that. Speaking of videos, you have one for Blue Oyster Cult, the song Blue Oyster Cult. You going to be doing more music videos? I could see this being almost like a long form video with all the songs on
it. I think I would like to do that. I don't know we did two videos. We did one for Black Telescope,
okay,
and one for Blue Oyster Cult. And both videos, we really Ace and I took, I don't know, like probably a month just figuring out how we're going to approach it, and then probably another 3 weeks to film it. So it took a long time. I have even grander ideas for, like, The Girl That Loved Me Blind or Siege and Investiture or even Imaginos itself. I mean, mm-hmm. Imaginos, I would love to film that in the Valley of Fire.
Mm.
And what is that, Arizona, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, wow. I did one video many years ago there, and it's just what a great looking location. I actually were planning on putting out a vinyl release, and so each disc, you know, it's going to be a double record disc. So each disc is going to have its own label. You know how they used to have the Columbia label,
right?
Red. Yeah. Well, this is going to be, each label on every side of the disc is going to be relating to what's on that.
So you're going to break it down by Quandary, Ghost, Dance, etc.?
Yes, yes.
All right.
And for the Ghost side, which has, those are the desert songs. That's Imaginos, Gil Blanco County, and to a degree, I guess, well, Blue Oyster Cult isn't really a desert. You know, that's really an aquatic song, but, you know, it's takes right. place on the shore, so
we'll let it slide. There you go. When would the vinyl be out? Do you have a target date?
Not quite yet.
Okay, I have a vinyl record store, and I would love to get it. I would love to sell that.
I mean, I yesterday I got the final master for the vinyl mastering, and today I got the final liner notes, which are written by David Frick.
Rolling Stone.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And oh my God, he goes deep into the story. It's actually wonderful. What a, you know, great honor it is to have him do my liner notes. So, You know, that's one of the things you love about a vinyl record.
Yep. Yep, the liner notes, the credits, you'd sit there, you'd put your headphones on, run up to your bedroom as a teenager and put on the new Blue Oyster Cult, and you just love the hell out of it. And I'm going to do that when this vinyl comes out. Like I said, I have a store and I live for vinyl, and I'm so glad to hear. I was going to ask you.
So it's going to be at least 12 weeks from, I would say, next week, you know, because we still don't have all the artwork done.
Same cover?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the outside cover is going to be the same. Of course, it's going to be much bigger.
Right, so. right.
You'll get it more into the. Maybe you'll see that flock of birds by the ship.
Right. Way back in the back, the ship's very microscopic on the CD. One thing I did want to ask you, and I never got a chance to ask Joe about it, and that is, you guys literally grew up on a farm, a working farm, correct?
Yeah, it wasn't. My dad was not a farmer. He was a technician at the. He would alternate between the radio station and the TV station in Watertown, New York.
Okay,
because they were owned by the same. It was the Watertown. The newspaper actually owned the radio station and the TV station, so they had like a
monopoly. Times.
Yeah, they had a little monopoly. It still do actually, but. So he was working out there, but he got this farm because he had, by the time he got the farm, I think there was five of us and one on the way. So,
okay.
And eventually there was seven altogether.
So how did you get into music basically living on a farm, or did you move around a lot? Was that just one phase of your youth?
We did move around a lot when I was really young. You know, we moved from different houses, and then we eventually moved in with our grandmother, and then, you know, within a year, we were living in Boston, and then my dad got the job with Voice of America, so we lived in Thessalonica, Greece, and for about a year and something, and then he came back, and he got a job with Stromberg Carlson Electronics as an R&D. Mm-hmm. Rochester, so we lived in Rochester for a year, and finally he got his old job back. I mean, originally he was just the radio technician in Watertown, but then when he came back, they said, okay, we'll give you your job back, but you're going to get twice as much stuff to do.
Wow, as it usually goes. But I was just curious how you guys came to music. I mean, you and Joe, obviously, a perfect rhythm section growing up together to form a band. I didn't know if music was in your DNA, if your parents were musical, or...
They were. My mom sang around the house all the time. She had a huge record collection, mostly Benny Goodman and Bing Crosby.
Because, okay.
Before she married my dad, she was a single girl in Chicago who worked for this guy named Tolson at the FBI.
Okay.
So she was a secretary in the FBI, and she had disposable income, so she bought all these records, you know. So she had a huge collection. So she would play those. And she would sing the songs, and my dad actually played guitar, but I did not know that. Okay. He played guitar in high school and taught my uncle how to play. You know, my uncle, who was a couple years younger than my dad, and they were best friends in high school, and he ended up marrying my dad's youngest sister. So my Uncle Bill, he was a weekend warrior.
Okay.
He had a job in a real estate company, but he also played every weekend, you know, at one or two or three local restaurants in the area with his little combo. And they would practice in his living room, and he had a whole set of stuff. He had drums and a piano and guitars and guitar amp.
So it is kind of in the DNA a little bit then.
Yeah, so he actually taught us how to play. He let us use the equipment because that's how he really got started, was using his band's equipment. You know, and then when we play gigs, we'd borrow stuff from the school or from other musicians. And then, you know, we didn't have anything in the beginning. But, you know, and then, I mean, we played about 500 shows before I went away to college. So,
wow.
we played every weekend, you know, and we started, I was in seventh grade and Joe was in sixth. So he was only 10 years old.
I would love to invite you back. We got cut a little short at the beginning of the hour, but yeah. I have so many things I'd like to be able to showcase. Okay. I want to play some Blue Coop music. I want to do some other things.
Yeah.
Fascinating to have you and Joe both within a month of each other, as I mentioned, a fan from years and years ago. So I'd like to close out with Imaginos and offer that invitation. I mean, is it okay if we call you back or arrange to have you come back on?
Yeah,
we have so much more to talk about.
My people, Great.
Okay, my people will call your people.
Okay.
All right. Great. Albert Bouchard has been my guest. We're going to leave you now with the title track, Imaginos, or as he calls it, Reimaginos. We'll be back with Albert again in the next couple of weeks. I promise I'll post it on Facebook. That said, go to my Facebook page. You'll find a link to the video for Blue Oyster Cult, and you'll find some more information on Albert. And I thank you all for staying with us today. I'll be back on, what day is it today? Friday? I'll be back on Tuesday. Stay safe, everyone, and stay healthy. Adios.
Such a song.